Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm looking for a way to live more simply, to look at connection between myself and my landscape, because there's probably somewhere inside there's a void that I still haven't filled just yet, or I haven't got to just yet.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Ian Finch. Ian is an expedition guide and adventure and outdoor photographer who cut his teeth in the adventure world as a Royal Marine Commando. Ian's desire to record, capture or lead expeditions in unfamiliar corners of the globe is clearly driven by his passion to learn about heritage and traditions from the native cultures that call those places home. In this episode, we talk about Ian's life and his journey into the world of expeditions, as well as talking through the stories of his last major expeditions. Okay? Over to Ian Finch. So, we'll start in the logical place. I think it would be useful for you to introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, whatever that means to you. What's your lifestyle like?
My name is Ian Finch. I'm a photographer, predominantly. A man who just has a passion for storytelling, for the outdoors, for culture, for anything that a story that moves people to action.
And where did that come from, and how have you got to where you are?
It's difficult to put a finger on anything like a starting point. It was something that was like a seed, like that just grew over many years of just being and spending a lot of time in the outdoors. I think my love of native cultures and indigenous cultures and the stories and the outlook of indigenous groups came from my dad. So I grew up in my dad's very much into history, into archaeology, into geometry and all this kind of stuff. So in my mum and dad's house, he had a beautiful cabinet that I grew up in. And in this cabinet, there was like books and Tibetan prayer wheels, Native American arrowheads. There was beads from native groups that he hadn't actually been there to collect them, but he had seen them maybe at antiques shows or had been, you know, collected them from certain places. And he had a book that was by one of my favorite photographers called Edward Curtis. And he was the last photographer to photograph the tribes in their actual state before sort of, you know, the Western expansion, the European expansion across the US. And he used plate photography. And as he created, I think, like 25 volumes, and it took him 15, 20 years to create all these incredible sepia photographs of all these Native American tribes and their regalia and everything. So I grew up around this love and sort of exposure to Native groups. And as I sort of progressed into the adventure world and photography and storytelling, I had this kind of goose pimple attachment, subconscious attachment, I think, to that love that my dad had. And I had this sort of, I would say, just this unconscious drive or desire to meet people, talk to people about their spiritual outlook in life and their connection to nature and their connection to the outdoors, what it was to be a native person in today's world with the struggle for modernism and the some aspects of the struggle for identity. And my whole sort of trajectory has that thread running through it. And now sort of a lot of sort of the expeditions that I do, I go away and speak to these people and maybe even bring stuff back, and I then add stuff to this cabinet now. So it's a real special sort of process. But even after many years of, you know, talking to my dad, and, you know, the kind of the male, the man to dad thing is never the closest relationship. There was always this slight distance between myself and my father. I see this now as maybe the things that I'm bringing back are like a peace offering to bring us back together, or not so much bring us back together, but to bring us closer. So I only worked that out when I started chatting to sort of like, a, you know, a professional a few years ago, you know, talking to, you know, getting stuff out of the system and all that kind of stuff. And that was maybe one of the journey, you know, one of the things that I found and most profound from those conversations. So a lot to do now, it's very important for me now to do these trips and for my own sort of journey, my own internal journey, but at the same time, I feel there's this, maybe this small unconscious drive to bring ourselves closer via that sort of subject matter maybe. But still for me, that, you know, I've sort of digressed off that question, but yeah, it's all about the story and all about bringing back something of value, a story of value, of impact, to educate. And it usually revolves around super wild places and native people and the connection, that kind of invisible connection between the both of them.
Yeah, and I think you've obviously just explained extremely well and like opened up huge kind of paths for us to walk down in a minute. And also obviously what you do now and what inspires and motivates you, but there's the obvious chunk that's the military life.
Mm.
You know, what was the motivation to join the Marines, and how old were you? What was your life like then? And how long did you stay for and things like that?
So I'd always been a person that just loved to use my body, like in physical body, in any form of like cross-country running or athletics and all that kind of stuff. So I knew how to push myself, even at a young age. I didn't know what it was that was driving me towards that. It was just a desire to push myself sort of physically and mentally. When you're at school, I mean, you don't have any concept of what that really is or what that means or what you're getting from it. You're just being the person that you are. So I'd always wanted to be a sports teacher. So I came out of school, I did some of my qualifications to go to university to become a sports teacher, because I think at heart, us storytellers, including you, you're a teacher at heart. There's that little nucleus of wanting to give something to other people to educate and help. So I got all my qualifications to become a sports teacher. And then there was always this ember of the military and wanting to do something in the military, and I dabbled with maybe the army, but then I again with conversations with my dad, and my dad's friend was a Marine, and over a few beers and a few whiskies, they were like, you know, it might be worth, you know, having to think about the Marines. So over a few years, I thought about the Marines, and I worked out exactly how I was going to train, how many press-ups I needed to do a day, how far I needed to run over like a 3-5 month period. And yet I chose to do the Marines, and it was a pure desire of just wanting to excel. If I was going to go into that field, I just wanted to excel at it. And also, I think there was a desire to see where my limits were, because I'd been proficient enough at school to be a good cross-country runner or a good runner. And I think when you mature, you're trying to search in for limits, and you're searching for where you could go and how far you could go. And I think with the Marines, it was like, right, I wanted to try and see where those limits were and excel and try and be the best at what I was going to invest all that time in. Cause I knew it was like a 5 to 7 year thing that it was going to be. I knew it was never going to be a career, a long-term career. It was more of a, let's see what I can do here and see what I can, not so much get out of it, but see where I can go, what I can achieve, how far I can go with this. And I just set that in process, like a 1 year mental thing of just making that happen, setting the time out when I was going to join, how fit I was going to be. But when you're in, you know, it's a slightly different dynamic, because you're brought out of the kind of ego about you. Now it's about the team. Now it's about sort of thinking about other people, different differences in abilities, how your strengths can lift up other people and how other people's strengths can lift up you. And that's now, that when I look back on that sort of period of life, the kind of physical skill sets and the things that you learn in there are not so much relevant anymore. It's the more the mental side now that is this kind of imprinted in that period where it's like your formative years, effectively 21, 22, and you're as a young man, you're learning the rules of life and things like that. So yeah, everything I move forward with now and the trips that we both do, you know, I'm always pulling on those things that I learned in the Marines.
And what did you get up to while you were there?
So I did, I joined at a time when the Iraq war in 2003 was just starting. So when I joined, it was going to be happening. So the Iraq war was in 2003. So March, I think it started 2003, and I joined in January 2003. So the training team were, you know, you're going to be, they didn't know how long this was going to be, how long this was going to last. So they were like, you know, you're training for the real thing now. This is not sort of a potential conflict. This is the real thing. So when I finished training in September 2003, that first wave had already finished. So the unit I joined, all those guys came back to the unit and I joined a company of guys that had obviously been at war. So that was really hard to, when you're sort of out of training and you have this like, I want to get stuck in, I want to get involved in as much as I can. You had to take a step back and be like, right, I'm not at the top of the pecking order anymore. Now I'm back to the bottom. Now I've got to prove myself. I've got to keep my head down, stay quiet. And just bide your time. Just take your time and prove yourself with everything. So I joined 2003. So Iraq happened and then I left sort of late 2007 towards 2008. So Afghanistan was just starting to get bad then. And at that point I had sort of gone to a different part of the Marines. So I was effectively undeployable at that point. So in between that, I did Norway, Mountain Arctic Warfare training and trained with the US Marines and did all sorts of different manner of things. So yeah, did some very, very cool stuff where you learn a lot about yourself and about the environment, what you're capable of and how to operate in different environments. So yeah, it was fun times.
Yeah. And what did you do when you left?
So when you leave the Marines, or the forces as a whole, I believe, you have a resettlement package. So you can relearn in any field of your choice. So you go away, you do the course, and then you have a few years where you're allowed, they will pay for that retraining. So you have to kind of go and do the course and then you kind of almost claim the money back. So I did like sports science, sports psychology, nutrition. I did physical training. I did a life coach course because I thought I fell back on the sports teacher side of things again, where I thought, but now I've got this footing and this foundation of the mental strength side of things in the Marines and the desire to sort of bring people together and achieve things together. Yeah, I thought maybe I'll just fall back on that again because that's what I love and what I know, how to move my body and the desire to help people. So I finished that, studied all that. And then I went into fitness training and training people for events and maybe endurance events. And I even worked in sort of did boot camp classes and, you know, trained people for Ironmans and did all manner of things. So yeah, that was feeding that side of things. But there was always this, again, this itch to go to another level, like push something in another area. So you start thinking about what you can do next. You know, it's like expeditions. I mean, you know that you're constantly thinking about where could we go? What could we do? How could I push this aspect of it? So there was always something there burning inside of me to go somewhere else and do something different. And funnily enough, when I left the Marines, when I chose to leave, I had this intuitive feeling of I'm going to be working for myself. I'm going to be doing something different when I leave. And yeah, I don't know how, I can't explain it. It was almost, it was an intuition, like a knowing that I was going to be doing something slightly different with my life after that.
And so how did it progress into the field that you work in now?
So I'd always been an outdoors person. So I'd always, in terms of go to North Wales and go to Scotland and Lake District, climbing, hiking, wild camping, I'd done that my whole life. And I was, when I came out of the Marines, it was more of a, right, I need a new challenge. I need to push myself in another way. So, and writing had always been my first medium. Photography was never my first medium. So at school, I loved Shakespeare. I loved poetry. I loved anything where I could creatively write and use my imagination to write a story or do anything. But I used to write a lot of poetry. I mean, it's a Marine and poetry, they did not go together, but I loved it. I actually loved it. And, you know, I stuck the odd letter through doors of women that I liked and that kind of stuff. So I decided to walk the length of the Outer Hebrides. I was like, I need a new challenge. I'm just going to, I bought a book called The Timeless Way, and it was a guy called Peter Clark who'd written this book in the 80s or maybe. And it was a route through the Outer Hebrides, and it was going over certain mountains and through certain beautiful sort of landscapes in the Hebrides and north to south, complete sort of journey of walking. And I read the book, and then I just plotted the route, and I thought, well, I'm just going to do this. I really fancy doing this in the summer. So I walked the route itself. And then as I was going, I was writing a journal, and I loved the aspect of moving through a landscape and recording the people that I had met, the sort of the aspect of the landscape itself and how things felt and the real visceral sort of aspects of storytelling about, you know, trying to put people in my shoes, feel what I felt and that side of things. So along that route, I don't think I took my DSLR. I think I just took my iPhone, and I was taking pictures along the way, and I was already been attracted to photography, but I had no idea in terms of, I had an eye for it. I believe I had an eye for it, but I didn't know what I was doing. You just took pictures because you was attracted to a scene and et cetera, et cetera. So on that trip, a lady from, might have been the Great Outdoors magazine or Trail Mag or something like that, she got wind of it, a lady called Mary, and then she contacted me. She goes, oh, we've seen this and seen that. So at that point, really, Instagram, then social media wasn't a thing at that point, really, in terms of storytelling and as we know it now. And she goes, do you want to do like a 3 or 4 page story in Trail Mag or whatever it was? I think it was Great Outdoors Mag. And have you got any photos? I was like, yeah, I've got these photos on my phone, and I'd done a tiny little edit on them. I'd done nothing of any significance. But yeah, and it went in the magazine. And then after that, I was like, I love that idea of doing something, writing about it, photographing it. You know, I loved that framework. Even though at that point I was still toying with the thing of, is the writing and the photography pulling me out of the experience? Is it sort of interrupting the experience? But I found that, you know, you can consciously still experience something, but then journal at the end of every day, which then became a format on my expeditions, was when you get in your tent or your bivvy at the end of the night, it's always like, even though you're knackered, always journaling, like feelings, thoughts, people, emotions at the end of every day. And even on some of my recent expeditions, it's like one of those things you're like, oh, I don't have to do this. But if you're writing the book or writing the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, those intricate moments, those details, you forget those. So journaling is like one of those things where you stay in contact with those tiny emotions and feelings of when you're just pissed off, wet, tired, cold, hungry. I mean, you know, that get lost in the system 1 month, 3 months, 6 months down the line. So, yeah. And then after that, I just started to focus a little bit more on the photography side of things. So I'd go on trips and I'd be just thinking, oh man, I want to sort of photograph this. I'd love to camp here and photograph that. Or I'd love to meet that person in, you know, near the Talisker distiller in Skye who's brought his oyster business up from 5 oysters, you know, from nothing to 5 oysters. So I just became interested in other people and then telling their story. And it was this real organic journey of wanting to meet people and find out who they were and what drove them. But there was always, 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 looking back, a connection between the person and the landscape. Always the connection. And because ultimately, I think looking back, and still now, even to this day, with my trips and sort of the narratives for the trips, I'm probably looking myself for understanding. Like, I'm still on that journey now. I've still not complete in that journey now. So I'm looking for a way to live more simply, to look at connection between myself and my landscape, because there's probably somewhere inside there's a void that I still haven't filled just yet, or I haven't got to just yet. So me, especially when I go in search of stories with regards to native groups, I'm looking for probably a spiritual or an emotional connection to something that's connected to the land. And I often think about that. So all the stories I've ever, and all the people I've ever met, I'm always looking for something to do with connection.
Connection to?
I think, not in terms of like, not from a religious perspective, it's more what drives people to do what they do, the passion behind what they do, but also the, I think it's something to do with the landscape, the connection to the land and why connection is important and why the land is important, to, not just as a whole to from a conservation environmental perspective, but our human connection to the landscape. Why is it important? And then retaining that importance as regards to heritage, knowledge, traditions. I don't know why I am drawn to that. It's just something that I feel really passionate about. And I feel if I'm drawn to it, there must be a void in myself towards that. Because you don't go after something that's full. You go after something that needs filling effectively. A void.
I mean, I completely agree. So this is obviously a loaded question, but it's quite obvious that you're connected to landscape around the world, et cetera, et cetera. But do you feel like you've got a home?
A home? I love England. I love England as a home and I love my family. But it's quite an interesting question because when I was actually, funny, just going back to the Hebrides, I met a lady who was rebuilding a croft in the Hebrides and she was pulling these like ropes. I was walking across this beautiful meadow with all these wildflowers in and she was rebuilding this croft and she was putting heather, which is obviously the traditional way of insulating a croft. She was pulling this rope and putting this heather on top of this house. Anyway, she came down and we had a chat in this field and she was showing me all these different types of wildflowers and what you could eat and what you couldn't. And she said, where do you belong to then? I said, this was on Harris, I think. And she was like, where do you belong to? And then I kind of looked at her and I was like, where do I belong to? I said, oh, I'm from London. And she was like, oh, okay. But it was the reframing of the question that is a completely, where do you come from and where do you belong to? If you think about that, that's two completely different questions. Completely different questions.
Radically.
Yeah, and that was like a mini like kind of shift in the power of questions and how you can, you know, when you have interviews with people or when you're talking to people, how a reframing of a question can elicit a completely different thought pattern, result and answer. So after that, I didn't have an answer for that. I couldn't, where do you belong to? You can ask a million people that and a million people, where do you belong to? I couldn't answer. But I still think about that today. And funny enough, we were wrecking a project a month before COVID hit in 2020. And we were interviewing a guy who was from Harris, but he lived in Glasgow. And he asked me the same thing. He was like, where do you belong to then? So maybe it was another way of just asking, where do you come from? But I had reframed it in a much more spiritual sort of deep way, which is like classically me. And I was then looking for the answer.
No, but it's interesting because it is. It's etymology, isn't it? It's like, you know, if you're looking at Scotland, I mean, people say, where do you stay? Or is that Ireland? Or both? Where do you stay? Which is, you know, where do you live? I mean, they're different things.
Yeah.
And I've noticed before, where do you stay? Well, that could be this week. But they mean, where do you live?
Yeah.
But it is that etymological difference between where are you from and where do you belong to? I mean, my answer is different for both. And I'm sure yours is.
What would your answer be then?
Well, where am I from is Grimsby, you know, but I don't belong there and haven't since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I don't know where I belong to. That's the point. I think I'm working that out. And that why I asked is because I'm guessing you are.
Yeah. I think like, if I think about that question, it's kind of, where do you belong to? It's like, I think it goes further than the person. I think it's like maybe an ancestral thing, but
We're having this conversation. It's the first time I've ever done a podcast at home. We're sat in Suffolk, which is not where I'm from, but my family are all from here.
Mm.
And I've got family buried in the ground here back to the 14th century. That's as far back as we can go. My mum's here. You know, my mad old aunt is here. So maybe I do belong here. I don't have the right accent. I don't know all the pathways yet, but I'm working on that.
Mm.
Because I, you know, like you, I mean, I think there's quite a lot we could talk about and we could probably do this for a few hours, but belonging, I mean, Sebastian Younger's written whole books on that.
Yeah, around, tribe.
Exactly,
yep.
On homecoming and belonging. Like,
yep.
That's what I've been lacking. Having a kid's helped, but yeah, it's. I mean, that sort of shocked me how brilliant a question that is.
Yeah,
where do you belong to?
It just reframes everything. And I mean, if from a, from your perspective as a filmmaker, if you were to ask people that, I mean, that's when that asked me, it stopped me in my tracks. And it's such a, I wouldn't say a deep question, but it's such a large question. It's such a, and it elicits, you know, it's an important question that deserves an important answer. But yeah, that, I don't think you can give that in a moment or 1 minute or 2 minutes. I mean, that's a, you got to go away and think about that, where you belong to, because it's like a sensory question where you've got to think, Christ, where do I belong to? You know, like, and is it important to you, that question? It is to me, because I think deeply like that. Other people, it might just be on the periphery, that kind of question that might not elicit such a, you know, they might hold not a lot of importance to that question, but for me, it does.
Yeah. No, and I'm fascinated as to why. And it's probably projection.
Maybe personally. Because that question resonates with us, because we are in search of belonging in some, or a place of belonging.
And that could be physical, it could be community, it could be passion.
Yeah. Looking for our place and what, you know, what we have to give. And
yeah. I mean, it's interesting you said, you know, England, and I'm totally with you on that. I'm an Anglophile who, but not in a Nigel Farage sense. I think that's my, and that's the problem, is when I felt so proudly English for so long, not because of, you know, poppies in the grass and stuff like that, just because it's where I'm from. And I love folk music. I love poetry as well. And particularly English old folk style. But because of how much things have changed over the last decade, I feel like I'm losing my sense of place, because I don't feel like I'm of this place anymore, if that makes sense.
Mm.
That's hard.
Yeah, and do you think the amount that you have travelled and worked in places like that, do you reckon that's, it's, I think, would you say if you were in a place for a long amount of time and you'd settled in a certain place and you were connected to your local area in a certain way, do you think travelling has impacted your sense of belonging?
Yeah, it's radically changed it.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually, this has become a bit of a theme for this podcast, but yeah, I mean, I've just come back from Jordan, Wadi Rum, and there are lots of issues with the way people live there, particularly if you look around, you know, women's rights, things like that, obviously. But the simplicity, which is a cliche kind of colonial thing to say, but the lack of clutter, but also the lack of, the presence of purpose and the presence of focus and the presence of community in a place where I feel so, well, like there's just no community, like radical disconnection from landscape particularly, mm-hmm. but from each other too.
Mm.
I mean, you know, this county we're in now, it's kind of a little bit of a backwater. And I think there is still community, but it's the older community.
Mm-hmm.
People are still connected to the landscape, but they're all the older people. You know, you go around the desert with the Bedouin, they can tell you the name of every plant, every hill, every, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Around here, you go for a walk in these woods we can see out the window with anyone from within 10 miles, and most of them can't tell you the names of the trees.
Yeah. I guess with those guys and those folks and those communities, there's still a necessity to know those plants and the landscape and what the weather means and what the weather's called and stuff like that. Over here, we don't have the need or the necessity to, because it's not life or death anymore for us here now, because life is, you know, radically changed. So we don't have the need to learn plants, trees, that kind of thing. But that, you know, after COVID and all the lockdowns and stuff like that, the resurgence in our connection to the outdoors and how important the outdoors is just, you know, I think it's one thing that we've got to bring the children of today in schools as like as a deep part of education, is helping children connect to the outdoors, and they're the custodians of the future. And when they care, when they learn about the landscape and the trees and the plants, when they learn about it, they'll care. And when they care, they'll protect it.
Yeah.
So
inevitably.
Yeah. So that's how I.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But you look at it again, it's a cliche, but you look at it through the eyes of a kid and they just want to be outside. They want to be outside. They want to mess around in the dirt and the earth, and they don't mind going out in the rain. We project that onto them. I'm like watching that in real time at the minute. We project this all like, oh, it's raining. My daughter doesn't care. You know, you stick her in a onesie and put her hood up and she'll march down this road and doesn't care. Anyway, you kind of gets into soapbox territory and it gets a bit ranty, but we are losing our way a bit. You know, the adventure side of things is so important, I think, because it does connect us to that landscape. Mm-hmm. It's how we access nature. It's the vehicle. But for you and I, so much more than just nature, adventure has led us to access community, culture, purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway.
And that's the one thing is that, especially with what we do, and you as, you know, predominantly you, because your time on location and doing these things is probably far greater than I sort of, my shoots and experiences are. But it's so important that I saw the camera and sometimes... The need to go and search for a story, and the need for a story is like a plane of glass between you and the experience itself. You can see the experience and you can see the landscape and you can see everything, but there's that thin plane of glass, and it's almost like a middleman that bounces. You can see everything experiential but beyond it, but you're not fully in it. So I've often thought that some of the trips I'm going to go on are going to be without a camera, going to be without this and without, which is torture for me and people like us, where we just like, oh my God, look at this and that. And but it's so important to go into it, into nature and that kind of thing, with the purpose of being present and using your senses rather than being finely tuned to be like, I've got to be up at this time of day to get that shot, or I've got to, on this trip, we've got to paddle this far or do this, you know. Like, sometimes it's, you just want to be in the outdoors and to just reset the senses and everything.
Do you do it?
I do, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do a lot of day walks, and I go and take a tarp and go and sleep in the woods near from where I live. I do it on my own. Like, I'm a classic introvert. So I love my own time. I love being in small groups of people, which obviously lends to expeditions and that kind of thing. But I will take a tarp and go and sleep in the woods on a Saturday night. That's how rock and roll I am. But no, not every week, but you know, once or twice a month. And I want to be up at sunrise. I want to be able to hear, like, when the birds stop their calls, and then the dawn chorus, and then the calls, you know, the barks of the muntjac, and like, I love that, absolutely love that. And that's, and have a fire, and like a little small fire, and if it's safe to do so, of course. But to have that time, that for me is like, I love that, absolutely love it. And the smells, you know, especially if there's been rain, or you know, I just feel that there's so much external stimulation nowadays from emails, phones, expectations, our own expectations and desires and pressures, that we kind of put ourselves in a bubble that almost stops the experience of nature.
But you're so right about, and I am so guilty of this.
We all are.
With that glass. But even, I mean, the phone, definitely. But the glass as a separation between you and the experience. I mean, I've always seen cameras as, you know, particularly with my background and where I'm from and stuff, it's like, it's been my ticket to access the world, has been carrying a camera. But it's not, you know, it's occurred to me before, particularly on trips, that I'm only here because of this, and this is why I'm here, and as a result, this is my trip. But I don't do it. And you're making me think, well, actually, it even alters where you put the tarp or where you put the fire.
Yeah,
because
of course
actually
it does.
Am I picking the best spot, or am I picking the most picturesque?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I should do it more. I mean, that's the problem, is everything, I'm constantly viewing everything as oh, I should go and do this and I should take photos. Oh, when I'm going to do this, I should photograph it because then everyone can see that I've done it, which is good for business.
Yeah. Yeah, when it's like that, it's kind of like an external
sort
of I should, I could, I would have, if you know, it's from that realm rather than just going and being present. You know, like even things like I heard someone the other day talk about the forest bathing, about going into nature and laying in nature. And I can't, I mean, I would be up, I'd love to try that kind of thing, but this is where people are now, you know. So after the social media revolution and phones taking over everything, you know, where there's an action, there's always a reaction. So this, I think the connection to nature and the importance of nature and wellness and mental health and that kind of thing is the reaction to the social media revolution, where we're getting pulled in on the pretense of being connected, but that under tow or the thread underneath that is we're being disconnected from who we are as people, you know, like, and even from friends. So I think nature is the great healer, the great sort of leveler. So if we can make time to spend more time in nature and the outdoors and then learn about even just our local woodland or our local tree species and the magic of each tree, that what, you know, things that magical things that oak trees do and ash trees or birch trees and the properties of birch trees or the plants that inhabit our hedgerows and stuff like that. It's about being present and knowing the beauty of what we have here. But we tend to go to far-flung regions in search of stuff like that. That's why people, like, you forget what's on your doorstep and you, in like people throughout the world, you know, who go to different, you know, you feel that you have to go far away to find something. But I don't think that's always the answer.
But again, it's that perception of adventure and exploration, which, you know, I've covered this ground so many times that I won't do it again. But adventure, you know, it's so relative and it's so personal.
It's a mindset.
Yeah, because you and I would go and have experiences that would be maybe slightly tedious or dull for us because we've got the privilege of experience and we're a bit older now.
Mm.
But I mean, this journey I just did in Wadi Rum, you know, it was incredibly adventurous. But the lad I was traveling with was 20. It was his first big trip like that. And I watched his mind changing, you know, in real time. Whereas for me, it was amazing. I loved it. But I wasn't changing, probably. Mm. But that can happen here. I mean, I don't know if you know, I'm sure you know Al Humphreys, but Alistair Humphreys did this amazing thing where he went, you can go on OSMap, OrdnanceSurvey.com. And you can print off a custom map with your house in the middle.
Yeah.
And so he did that and he was like, well, I'm going to visit every grid square.
Okay, that's a good idea.
And I was kind of like, it's obviously very controlled, but equally there's grid squares, you know, in Ipswich or wherever that you'd never dream of going to for. But that's adventurous.
It is, yeah. And for adventure for you in the future, moving forward with your children, that's going to change, you know, because adventure for you might bring an adventure to them. It's going to be a whole new ball game.
Oh, but even I think people are often, particularly, you know, I had dinner at this table last night with my in-laws and they were like, oh, do you not get bored around here? I'm like, no, there's so much woodland around here and I love running with the dog. And so sometimes I'll get to a path, you know, there's a fork in the road, three forks in the road, and I kind of go, I've actually never been that way.
Mm.
Rather than getting my map out, looking at my watch, I kind of just go, let's go that way.
Mm.
And it's adventurous. Mm. And, oh, there's a felled tree. Oh, I'll have to jump that. Or, oh, actually, I'm a bit lost now.
Mm.
I'm not in danger. Can I get back to the car without using my phone? That's adventurous. It's fun. It requires me to use some skills.
Yeah.
I go, oh, I know which way west is because the sun's setting. You know, or my nose, I can sense where I've turned and where I've gone. And it's not difficult to find.
No, and we're losing track of that, I believe, that ancestral sort of human sense of our connection to the outdoors, but kind of in terms of the signs and signals and symbols of the outdoors, you know, and sun, where the sun is at certain points of the day, and certain shapes of trees can tell you where the south is, and bluebells and all that kind of stuff, you know, like that's pretty special stuff when it comes to landscape. And there's that chap called Tristan Gooley, is it?
Yeah.
The Natural Navigation.
I haven't read it, but I do own it. Yeah.
Yeah. And even that, like, that's reconnecting us to our sort of primal senses and spatial awareness within the landscape and what things are changing and moving and where our place is. And also the wildlife the, you know, the patterns of birds, muntjac, deer, all that kind of, or local wildlife. But it's fascinating stuff. And what that does is, you know, you're building a picture by learning all of those things. You're building a picture of your immediate sort of landscape and learning at when those plants are coming in and when they're going out, and when those patterns of those animals are moving and that kind of thing. And it's all just bringing you into the moment rather than being pulled out of the moment by technology, social media, phones, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, most of us need Google Maps to get to Tesco.
Yeah.
Let alone, you know, looking, oh, well, moss only grows on the north side of trees, or, you know.
Yeah.
I don't actually know much about that sort of thing.
It is cool. It's a cool subject matter. I've read a fair bit about it, and I'm, you know, you don't really use it a huge amount, but it's fun to know. It's good to know. But also, if you learn about those kind of things in your local landscape, if you were to go somewhere else, there's the same knowledge, local knowledge and desire with the Bedouin or the Yupik people of Alaska who I've met. You know, there's a connection to their local landscapes, and they'll know when the salmon are running in Alaska. You know, I was taught certain plants, even like not daffodils. There's a certain plant that catches the wind in June, and when that's flying, the salmon are running. Just things like that, you know, beautiful. And that's the same thing. It's a connection to the landscape and what's happening at that time. And that I believe is like the knowledge and the connection that might be not so much need to be reconnected, but we just re-establish ourselves with it. It's not gone anywhere. That knowledge is there.
But this might sound like a digression, but I'm so fascinated. I think because we have a lot in common in the way we think, actually, and I think some of our past experiences, like you talk about the connection or lack of in part with your father, and this cabinet of oddities and curiosities, and then professional help you talked about.
Yeah.
But then also this search of connection to place and people. I think it might be worth, if you're happy to, kind of building on that a bit and explaining where that all came from, particularly around the kind of professional side and why you decided to go down that route and what for.
I think it was being an introvert, a natural for me to go into nature and like think and deeply think. And I've, you know, the life coach course, I wouldn't have done that if I wasn't looking for some answers to understand myself. And it was more of just a understand my some patterns and behaviors. I'd suffered like for anxiety quite badly for quite a few years. It was more of, I think probably looking back, it was more of a search to what's the causes of anxiety and any sort of mental health stuff, how to overcome it. Like I was treating it almost like the training for Marines. So it's like, okay, what's the problem? How do I overcome it? Like even like expeditions, it's the same kind of thing, which is a bit rigid and structural, but that was my way of just sort of trying to get through things. And it was a working on sort of the relationship between my mother and my father and understanding that, where I fit within that dynamic, and having sort of certain avoidant parts of my nature where avoidant of conflict and that kind of thing. So I actually went in search of answers, which is, I guess, the actual, now I've even said it, it's probably like the story of my life. Going in search of answers and search of meaning, understanding that I can sort of just improve myself in some way. Not that I should really need improving. You know, you're perfect just the way we are, with all our fallibilities and ups and downs and everything. That's the beauty of human nature. But yeah, I just went in search of what was causing this anxiety, you know, quite bad anxiety that I had. And also, I think a big stepping stage to sort of really moving through that was just kind of accepting that I was an introvert. Like because all of my friends, I'm surrounded by, especially in our industry, by people, egos, people that are really good at things. And it's an intimidating world to be in. And if we want to excel in our world, both of our worlds, we work in kind of the same sort of arena. We're around people that are good at stuff. And, you know, I think at first I was probably, you know, before I'd even got into this line of work, there was probably some holes that needed filling. And I was just going looking for answers and just to sort of strengthen myself and work out why I was. And yeah, and that whole introvert thing was that I was around a lot of people, my friends who were extroverted. So I was always competing. And when you're competing, you're competing with yourself ultimately. So that's when there's that disconnection with who you are, because you're not being true to who you are. You don't understand. I didn't understand that at that point. So when I came to the conclusion, I thought, yeah, I'm definitely an introvert, and became an accepting of that. It was like a little weight was lifted, because I had some understanding. I was like, yeah, I'm that kind of person, and I'm actually pretty cool being that person. Like, I'm comfortable being that person now. Because there's almost like a, like, oh, introvert, oh God, you know, you like being on your own and doing all this kind of stuff, and like socially, not awkward, but socially, you remove yourself from all this kind of stuff. But I had to work out how to be almost a little bit extroverted. So I had to learn, almost, it sounds so crazy, but I had to learn some skills of like, right, you know, putting yourself out there and like really doing away, you know, accepting who you are and be like, right, okay, this is, I need to go out of myself a little bit here and try a little bit harder with these kind of things. And it brought me closer to the person that I'm, you know, maturity and age comes with this, I think. You know, you just start to learn a little bit about who you are, what you want, what you don't want, what you stand for, what you don't stand for, what you deserve, et cetera, et cetera. And I just did a lot of work, a lot of reading, a lot of soul searching. And not that I had any major trauma as a child or any of that kind of stuff, but we've all had some kind of trauma, everybody. You know, we've all, some way or another, had something that sort of permeates our beliefs and behaviours today. And I think when I started to do that work, I did honestly retreat into nature. I retreated into nature, and I was like going for lots of walks, lots of wild camps with just small groups of people. And something, like I said, go like into the woods with a tarp and have a fire by myself and stuff like that, and did a lot of work. And now I'm probably the happiest in this field doing what I'm doing now, the happiest I've probably ever been. I'm telling stories of other people that can educate and entertain the world. And I really value that.
You feel purposeful?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely feel purposeful. I think there's so much beauty and knowledge and people in the world that have so many incredible stories to tell, that I think it's a joy to I'm very lucky for what I'm able to do, and I feel very blessed and very grateful for what I do. So I just try to bring these stories back that can help educate people and enrich their lives. I mean, you do the same, right? I imagine with your stories, your films, you know, we're drinking from the same cup.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you've just talked about as well, and some of the things you said, like, because you and I are technically competition, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Like, there's cross, you know, we both do different stuff. You don't run a podcast and I don't do any guiding.
Yeah.
But we both shoot photos for a living. But like, and we talked about this a bit before we started, but it's the whole, where does the ego live versus that sense of community? I would so much rather be like connected to people. I mean, we love the same thing. You know, we like going into wild places and meeting fascinating and interesting people and exploring those cultures, communities and landscapes through the process of taking photos of it.
Mm.
So we could choose to not like each other because we're technically competition.
Mm.
Or you can bond with someone over that. And I think that's a bit of it's a unfortunately common human trait, is to actually push away the people who we could be really close with because we feel threatened by them.
Mm. Yeah, especially professionally, where money and sort of that kind of thing's involved, or your career, your progression is involved. I mean, I've met photographers when I started out that inspired me beyond measure and almost gave me permission that you are good enough. One person in particular. And then I went back to that person a few years later. I was like, how do I do this and how do I do that? And it was like silence.
Yeah.
So, but we spoke about just before the podcast started about how to... that we should be lifting people up and lifting people so they can follow their passion. If they're passionate about photography, storytelling, filmmaking, that we have a very good position that we can just say to these people, look, we can help you, or this is the tips and da-da-da, or connections and stuff. I've got no problem putting any photographer in contact with people that I've worked with or I am working with. Because I think that these people are on their own journey, and they're trying to create a life that they want and they dream of. And why I can help someone achieve something that they would be so happy with, right? Oh, and what, my ego get in the way of that? Because I don't want them to take my role on a shoot or something like that. No, that's bullshit.
Yeah. And I agree. And obviously we've talked about that, but maybe it's easier for us now. We've reached a certain point in our careers where we've got some confidence despite the constant imposter syndrome. Because actually you do go, Or I go, that'll be all right. There is enough. I've got enough of a CV now and enough of a portfolio that, you know, I don't feel like I've made it yet, but I certainly feel like I could go and find some work if I needed to.
Yeah.
It's the lack of threat, probably.
Yeah.
And competition's good for you because it keeps you on your toes.
Of course it does. It keeps you sharp, keeps you on your toes. It keeps you evolving and moving forward, looking for new ways of shooting, new, you know, new creative directions. I think competition and that kind of thing is healthy in the creative world. Plus, if you've got competition, you're going to innovate and you're going to push boundaries. You're going to look for maybe a story that's slightly different or has got a slightly different edge or something like that. So competition is healthy. You should welcome competition.
Yeah.
I think, personally.
So I'm going to digress because I want to have time to do it properly. But given everything we've talked about and everything we've said and all of the kind of reasons and justifications and ambitions and the journey, how do you end up travelling over to America with a wooden paddle and going out there for a few months? And what did you do and why?
So that trip was, we were following a trail. Well, it's not a trail as we, like in sort of the normal sense of there's a path through the trees, kind of trail or something like that. So the route that we followed was a route where the Cherokee were removed during sort of the Western expansion. They were removed from their ancestral homelands in the Great Smoky Mountains, and they were moved to effectively Indian territory. That's what it was initially called, but now it's Oklahoma. So they were moved along a certain route, and that was called the Trail of Tears. And the reason why that was called that was because the time of year that they moved, that they were forcibly moved with ultimately the clothes they had on their back. It was moved in winter, and a lot of people died. A lot of Cherokee people died at that point on that journey. So they were made to walk a certain distance. So they're split into many different sort of detachments, effectively. So there was military detachments that all walked to the Cherokee. They took the Cherokee on flatbed boats, up the Tennessee River, over the Ohio, and down the Mississippi. They walked them thousands of miles, and lots of Cherokee people died there. So on that route. So I had one of my friends who actually came on the expedition with me. We were, funny enough, in a cafe in the Cotswolds, just having a, you know, classic English fry-up. And I said to him, if money was no object, what trip would you do next year? It's a classic question, you know. It's just like, it's that kind of spark of, I think if money was no object, I'd just do this. And he said, oh, have you heard of the Trail of Tears? And I was like, I haven't heard that. And he goes, it's a native story and it's this. And he goes, it's all, he told me sort of the basic sort of background to the story. And I went home that weekend. And then the following week, I was like, do you ever fancy doing that? We can put that together and tell the story and connect with the Cherokee Nation and see if we can put like a real, real sort of in-depth story together where we follow it. But the difficult parts of that is two white European chaps telling a native story, which is it's a bit of a sticking point, and we kind of ummed and ahed about it. But we thought if we can tell it from an authentic view and tell it from the ground, being on the ground, and then connecting with the Cherokee Nation and working with them through the process, which is what we did, we can tell it or tell a part of the story through some of the places we go through on the route. We can tell it from our eyes and just tell an authentic story and bring that story into the UK, which is, you know, we don't know really anything, a huge backgrounds about Native American story or when people are moved and put into sort of areas where there's reservations. We're not exposed to it over here because it's not part of our effective, you know, our landmass history. It's more of an American history, obviously. So yeah, we spent a year and a half planning that and done that in 2019.
And what did you actually do, I guess?
So we crossed the Great Smoky Mountains from one side to the other. And then the year before, so when we came up with the idea, I went over for 3 weeks and wrecked the whole route. So I drove the whole route, found people who could sell secondhand canoes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And kind of, as you know, you piece together like that kind of blueprint of the whole journey and connected with certain people along the whole route. And literally I walked into the REI and I was like, I need to speak to someone who sells secondhand canoes. So I spoke to this young lad called Eric, whose father sold secondhand canoes. And then I went to their house, bought and paid for the canoe at this guy's house out in Tennessee. And I said, like, could you be our point of contact next year when we come back? So we sent him all of like the all of the gear, all of the food from Firepot, which we had to send twice because we couldn't get the meat versions into, they were destroyed at customs. Oh. So we had to send vegan versions all the way to the US, like hundreds of meals that cost a fortune. And we sent it all to that guy. So we crossed the Great Smoky Mountains on foot. That took 7 or 8 days. And then we dropped down to the Tennessee River where we met that guy who had literally the canoe, some extra paddles, a couple of weeks worth of food, like barrels of equipment, which we'd sent all over. So it was literally like a lift and shift. And then we paddled the Tennessee River, the Ohio River and the Mississippi River. It took about 6 or 7 weeks of just continuous paddling on the river. And we're talking like into tornado season. So you're going into tornado season and they're calling them the spring winds, which are these winds that just kick up over for a couple of weeks when sort of transition from winter to spring happened. And then we dumped the canoe. We sold the canoe once we got to Memphis. So this is all actually parts of the route. So we were going through all these areas that the Cherokee had been taken taken along. And then we were researching stuff when we were getting into these cities and towns. We were looking at historical areas. We were making notes of certain things, obviously lots of photography and et cetera. And then we walked on foot from Memphis to Oklahoma, which was about 450 miles on foot. But the issue with that one was that the Trail of Tears itself from Memphis to Oklahoma was a dirt track back in the days. Now it's highways and roads. So we walked pretty much on the hard shoulder for 400 miles, which was savage. And just like, you get into, as you know, like when you get into a zone and you know each day what you got to do, the target you need to hit, da, 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 da. It was emotional, but we had planned, once we got to the end, I'd connected with the Cherokee Nation at the start of the trip, firstly to get permission that we could actually do this trip. So we thought it'd be best to contact Cherokee Nation and say, look, we're two guys who want to do this trip. This is a story you want to tell. Can we have permission to do the trip? And then at the end, we'd love to connect with you for a week and spend time with Cherokee people for a week and get them, you know, take a bit more of a deep dive into the story itself and speak to people connected to the Trail of Tears. So once we got to the end of the trip, we had organized with the Cherokee Nation to have two young Cherokee brothers and a slightly older chap who was connected to the Trail of Tears, ancestrally to the Trail of Tears. And he was a language expert. So he was actually translating Cherokee to Apple. So he was getting an Apple keyboard made up so the Cherokee Nation of today in the universities could actually speak Cherokee on their Apple phones and laptops and do that kind of thing. So he was really, really interesting to talk to. But the two young Cherokee brothers, Parker and Ryder, we had planned that we wanted to finish the trip walking the last 6 miles with the Cherokee brothers. And in that 6 miles, we were just like asking questions about what it's like to be a native man in America today, the Cherokee, what's the future of Cherokee, you know, the Cherokee Nation and stuff like that. And we spent actually the last week with them and they took us to powwows. We had like drumming sessions with them. So we'd spent time with a couple of Navajo guys and them, and we had like drumming with them. And they were taking us to these projects where they were growing these things called historically the Three Sisters, which is, I think it's corn, squash. There's another vegetable that they grow. I have to recently remember that, and they're regrowing that. And that's traditionally what the Cherokee used to eat, the Three Sisters, the three foods. So he was creating a kind of a local community project where he was bringing all those foods back. So we went there and learned about all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and that was pretty emotional. That was a pretty emotional week because we finished that. Well, it was like 70 odd days worth of doing that like consistently, and we finished it at the Cherokee Heritage Center, which is kind of this real beautiful museum where they have all of stuff from the Trail of Tears. They have all of these like traditional native Cherokee artifacts. They also have an archive in the back where it has all the Cherokee baskets that have all been found all over the country, and it's all kind of condensed and kept there. So we got access to that and we photographed all the baskets and all these masks and traditional like sort of ceremonial masks. And when we finished the trip, when they were walking with us, they took their shoes off. So they walked the last 6 miles with their shoes off and in like honor of the people like walking that route with their, you know, bare foot. and it was raining, and I remember it was really humid. There was like thunderstorms, and they walked, and it was like so powerful. And we got to the Cherokee Heritage Center, and there was a small group of people that worked at the Cherokee Heritage Center, Cherokee people that were waiting for us with just a silver pot on the floor with watermelon in. And we finished the trip, and me and Jamie just hugged each other, in that awkward way guys do. And then we sat there on the floor of like this foyer of like this museum and just ate watermelon.
Perfect.
And then we went and slept in the church. There was like a little kind of on-grounds church there that they had, and we slept in the church for a week on the floor on mats and sleeping bags. But then we met these beautiful people who were classed as national treasures. So in the Cherokee Nation, which is the largest native nation in the US, they have national treasures, and these are people that are responsible for retaining certain aspects of the Cherokee culture and sort of perpetuating those aspects of culture. So the lady that we met, which was Parker and Writer's mum, she was called Tonya, and she was a dressmaker, so she would make traditional Cherokee dresses. So we spoke to her for hours and hours and hours on end, and saw her dresses and saw how she was making the dresses, et cetera, et cetera. So we got a pretty deep dive into the Cherokee culture for that week or two. You know, there's a lot more to it and a lot more sort of historical sort of aspects that we would love to go back and spend more time with them. And then obviously that featured in Sidetracked, and, you know, looking back on that, there was loads of things we could have done differently and photographs that I wish I could have taken that I didn't, but it is what it is. And we were blessed and honoured to have been given the opportunity to do that.
How did it change you?
I mean, you might agree with this, that the world appears a scary place before expeditions, but you go into them, and the generosity that you receive from local people changes your perception of what generosity and the amount of what can be given in under the spectrum of generosity. Like time, friendship is what we encountered along the whole way. Everybody was also always so interested in what we had done. But it changed me in the perspective of what generosity means and how I can improve on me being generous to other people with just being a friend, being kind and giving my time. And how that can change the course of someone's journey, life, whatever, you know. And the story of the Cherokee was hugely impactful and something that just reinforced my sort of desire to go and tell those or to share those kind of stories and bring light to some of those stories. Is expeditions do change you. They change the way you see the world and how you show up. I mean, you know that as well, what some of the mad stuff you've done.
Well, for you, it's items for your dad's cabinet, whether metaphorical or literal.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's actually something that it's Father's Day this weekend, isn't it? So I was in Sweden, northern Sweden, up near the Sami people in Feb. So I've got something to add to that cabinet today.
Oh, there you go. Oh, no way.
Yeah. Are
you going up today?
I'm going from here to see them.
Oh,
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it's an antler knife and like beautiful like sort of sheath kind of thing that I got from out there.
That's incredible. Ace. Yeah. Cool. Right, I'm going to draw it to a close. We've just hit an hour.
Nice, quick hour.
Yeah. So I always ask people two questions at the end of every podcast. Just answer them however you wish or interpret them however you wish. Mm. What scares you?
Oof. What scares me? That's a good question. I'm not sure if I have to probably think about this answer a bit more. Nothing physical scares me in terms of... Well, you might have to edit this one. Chop it down a bit.
I like the pondering.
What scares me?
What's your gut saying?
My gut is... I want to live a life of impact and I want to help people learn and inspire people to achieve greatness in their lives. And it doesn't scare me, but it scares me that I might not achieve that. I don't know why that's might seem a bit self-serving.
I rarely either interrupt or comment on this question, but I think you and I have a lot of crossover actually, and I think we might be similar age, but that's about purpose. Everything you've just said is, you know, we're such a... I'm not going to do the soapbox. It's about purpose, right?
Yeah.
What you just said is...
Yeah. What scares me? I'll tell you what scares me. Yes, I found it. Is making sure that I've used, especially post-COVID, post-lockdowns, that I'm spending enough time with my family, my mum and my dad. Sounds a bit sort of soppy, but that is massive for me. That's why I'm going there today. You know, like after COVID and lockdowns, I'm there every 3 or 4 weeks and they live like 2.5 hours. So I'm very, very blessed to have them both in this world and have them nearby. But it scares me when my mum or my dad passes. That scares me.
Yeah. What brings you hope?
Brings me hope. When I go into the world with a certain perception of how a certain place is going to be or certain people are going to be, and you go there and it's not what you think, and people are more generous and more kind and more willing to help than you think, that gives me hope, because you know, it just goes to show that your preconceptions of the world and your own world that you live in and thinking and believe in and stuff like that may not be as bad as you think. And yeah, that gives me hope.
Amazing. I'm going to pick on you. I've got one more question.
Go for it.
Where do you belong to?
Oh, where do I belong to? My God. Where do I belong to? I do have that strong connection to England, the English landscape. I don't know why, but the patchwork English landscape, I'm so drawn to that from a kind of human sense. And like, when I think of where do I belong to, I think like try and think deep down, where do I belong to? And England, there is a love for the English landscape. It's where I retreat to, right? So if there's a need for that. So yeah, I would say that kind of, I would say England. I belong to England. We ultimately belong to the world, and that's cheesy. You can cut that bit out.
Thanks, mate. That was
all right,
mate.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft and is produced and edited by Orla O'Murray. If you want to get in touch, then you can do so at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk, or you can get in touch on Instagram. And finally, please do leave us a review on iTunes. They make the world of difference to us accessing new audiences.